So this morning is our first class with 1 Samuel. The only other class I've taught is Job, and for this one I wanted to give it more of an introduction than I did with Job, get into some of the background a little deeper, but I also wanted to get started quickly. And to get started with Samuel quickly, you really have to go into chapter 2 because Hannah's song is referring to everything that happened in chapter 1. And so I couldn't really do both. So I'm trying to have an introduction class. Hopefully it goes long enough. If not, we'll probably just read the text and we may get into it a little bit here. I'm already finding it harder to deal with than Job because Job, it's nice and neat. Every chapter is its own thing. This speech is this chapter, the next chapter is this speech, and it's all nice and divided for us already, nice and neatly. This is going to be a little more difficult, but that's okay. So we're starting in 1 Samuel, and we'll start with the boring, not really that important stuff first, like author and date, which is ultimately unknown, which you kind of run to a lot here in the Old Testament. 1 Chronicles 29:29 mentions the records written by Samuel about the acts of David. And a lot of people think, oh, then it must be referring to what we have that Samuel's involved in, the book of Samuel. But Samuel dies in 1 Samuel 25. So if he did write any of the book of Samuel, he didn't write most of it because he would have been dead. So it may be true, but it's unlikely. Others feel that Samuel was probably written in stages over time. As history passed, these things were recorded by different people, and ultimately it was brought together. Or it could have been documented by other prophets, or those already existing documents were put together by the prophets. But there's actually one really interesting and really complicated theory of the Deuteronomist historian, which I won't get to a lot of because I don't fully understand it. It basically comes down to that there was an editor who compiled all the records from various sources and added his own commentary in certain places, supplemented some information that was missing. And there are people who feel that somebody did that for, like, from Numbers to, like, 2 Chronicles, that there was one guy who was behind it all, putting all these records together and editing them. So that's a possibility. That theory wasn't popular until the 20th century. I thought that was pretty interesting. So that's the boring stuff. And as far as date, the closest estimation that I got that this was the book of Samuel was completely compiled, and that estimation was 842 BC, which is during the reign of Jehu. And that seemed pretty arbitrary as far as estimations. It's really hard to tell, hard to guess when it was finally completed and people were able to read it altogether. Something a little more interesting, the literary features of the book. It's technically a history, but it really focuses on technically one person, David, and two others, Samuel and Saul. The ESV Study Bible actually characterizes it as a hero story, and I really liked the sound of that because it kind of reminded me of ancient epics like Homer or the Iliad, where it focuses on this hero and his great epic tale, and that kind of reminds me of David and his long tale of how he became king and his kingship and the tragedy in his life. So I actually like the story of or the sound of a hero story. Of course, it's mostly prose, as we know, but there are elements of poetry, and of course, prophecy. One of the biggest themes of the book is prophetic authority, that God has chosen certain people to carry his message to his nation, and that those people have his authority to say those things, and sometimes they go beyond their authority, and he has to correct them. But the things that he tells them to say, they come to pass. And of course, one of the most famous pieces of poetry in the Bible is Hannah's prayer or Hannah's song. And that's, of course, in chapter 2 of the book. Any comments? on any of that? Somebody who knows more about those kinds of things than I do who would like to add to that discussion? I was going to mention that in the Hebrew Bible, 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings are all gathered together under one heading, and it's the books of the kingdoms. They're still split into four different books, but they're called the books of the kingdom. So 1 and 2 Samuel, which is one book, is actually 1 and 2 Kingdoms in the Hebrew Bible. I thought that was interesting. But besides that, I didn't have anything else to say on it.
The other thing that I was going to say about it is the reason that Samuel and the Kings and the Chronicles are all divided is because of scroll length. They had the first Samuel scroll and the second Samuel scroll.
Right.
You know, Samuel was so successful, they all decided to write a sequel.
Right.
It really is a unified story.
Exactly. Right, and that's part of the trouble that I had coming to doing an introduction of 1 Samuel is really you're doing an introduction of 1 and 2 Samuel. Because it is one book, one story, the story of David. But anything else?
Yeah. I think a lot of people take Samuel and Kings together as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to mention that the actual event of Samuel is estimated to take place from 1050 to 970 BC, and since, as you said, Samuel and Kings are kind of thrown together, looked at together, that's 500 years of history being covered in those four books, which is really interesting to me to think about. Anything else? Awesome.
Samuel, name.
Samuel is, actually read this right before I came here. I think it's the name of the Lord is El or something, or the name of God is, yeah.
What does Sam mean?
I'm not sure. The name.
Who? Ask.
Ask.
Well, ask.
Okay.
Because his mother asked.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Right, and yeah, and that is where the name of the book comes from. It's not authorship, Samuel, because he wrote it. It's Samuel because he is one of the main focal points of it. He's the kingmaker of Israel, with God, of course. But God uses Samuel to appoint the kings. All right, so something more interesting, more helpful for us is the purpose, importance, and the importance of the story. Of Samuel, and it's really the story of Israel's transition to a monarchy and the establishment of the Davidic dynasty. As I said, in the Hebrew Bible, Samuel and Kings are characterized as the books of the kingdoms. So what we know as 1 Samuel is 1 Kingdoms. And actually, in the Hebrew Bible, 1 Samuel is immediately preceded by Judges. So the last thing you read before you get to Samuel is the last verse of Judges, which says, "In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did was right in his own eyes." And that's a statement that's repeatedly brought up in Judges, this reminder that there was no king in Israel, there was no central authority. These judges were regional, they were temporary, they did a certain task that God had appointed them for, and that was their role, but there was no king in Israel. And it kind of alludes to the fact that, you know, really there was a king in Israel, it was God, but to the people there was no king. They disobeyed, they ignored his authority, and so to the Israelites there was no king in Israel. But Judges builds on that anticipation of a future king, Israel's desire for a king that will be made more explicit in Samuel. And it sets the stage for Samuel, the kingmaker of Israel. And that connection to the book of Judges is evidenced in the book of Samuel itself. To name one of the comparisons between the two, if you look at Samson and Samuel's birth, there's actually a lot of places to compare and a lot of places to contrast, and like a barren woman receiving a child from God who is meant to be set apart in service to the Lord. And of course, there's a divergence at some point between Samson and Samuel that we'll talk about. But there's a lot of little interesting comparisons to be made between the two books. Also important is the transition between Samuel, Saul, and David. Samuel represents the way things that have been done in Israel. He's the last judge of Israel. His sons show the corrupt leadership, and Eli's sons show the corrupt leadership of Israel, and the way things that have been, the corruption of the people of Israel themselves, and their disobedience. Saul shows the way the Israelites want things. He's the type of king they expected. When they look at him, he looks like a king. He's a kingly kind of person. And he ends up being unworthy of the crown. And so God chooses another man, David, a man after God's own heart, someone that he would choose to be king rather than the Israelites looking for an earthly, brawny, strong, good-looking guy to be king. God chooses a man after his own heart to be king. And he's the first to be placed on an eternal throne that will be eternal through Christ. And the establishment of the Davidic dynasty is one of the most significant periods of Israel's history and in God's plan of salvation. Through David, God establishes the throne Christ will occupy for eternity. And of course, in a practical historical sense, the establishment of the kingship of Israel would change the course of Israel's future forever. Its effect can't be overstated on the history of Israel, the relationship Israel has with God and other countries. It's something that we kind of know. Like, of course, they're getting a king. That's a big deal. They never had a king before. God has warned them about kings, how they really don't need one. But we really should take this moment to think about that this is one of the most pivotal times in Israel's history and in our history, because it is when God sets up this Davidic covenant and prepares the way for Christ to become king. Any comments on those notes? You always look like you're about to say something.
Well, what you were saying about Saul being kind of the king that people wanted and their expectations really ties in nicely with the judges, people doing what's right in their own eyes.
Right. Mm-hmm.
There's the tragic vow that he makes regarding his son, like the tragic vow that Jephthah makes about his daughter. There's the fact that he dies in the hand of his armor bearer, like Abimelech, and says, kill me less. He said, a woman killed me.
Right.
It seems that every other page, Saul's doing something that wasn't one of the good things that the judges did.
Right.
Re-emphasizes that fact that it's human wisdom to have this big, strong,
Right. I'll keep commenting on that in a second, actually. I have something else to say about that. But anything else? All right. I'd like to take a look at the themes that we'll come across in the book. This kind of ties in with what Mr. Ward was saying, but it's the juxtaposition of the kingships of Saul and David to that of God's own kingship. As we said, as Mr. Ward was saying, Saul is this earthly king with earthly expectations, and that's exactly what they get, is an earthly king who does earthly things and acts in an earthly way. And then David is chosen, and he's a godly and righteous man who wishes to please God, but he, of course, is also sinful and is also imperfect and also makes his mistakes, and that's in stark contrast with the kingship of God, who is all-knowing, all-perfect, true justice towards his people. Again, David is a worthy man who does seek to please God, who does seek to do the right thing, but of course he isn't perfect. And so we only see true, perfect kingship in God. God is the only one capable of holding the office of king with absolute integrity and holiness. Throughout the book, we'll also see God's guidance, especially in Hannah, who is barren, and God provides her with a child. He guides Samuel in his service to God, and he guides David through hardships, specifically as he flees from Saul, as we'll see in 1 Samuel. Any comments on those themes? Okay. All right. Before we get into the text itself, which I'm actually glad we can get into today rather than waiting, I just want to set up a little historical context. We know that Joshua, the book of Joshua, tells of how the Israelites conquered and came to occupy the land, and Judges shows us the fickleness of the Israelites as they go through phase after phase of obeying, disobeying, oppression, then going back to being obedient. We see that the judges themselves, who are charged with the salvation of Israel, are fickle and corrupt themselves at times. And throughout, we're reminded that in those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And so at the beginning of Samuel, this is the state that the Israelites find themselves in. They have no true spiritual leadership. No reliable spiritual leadership. Eli does seem to be a good man, but he has his faults. His sons are corrupt and not good examples for the people. And we'll see that Samuel has a similar problem. Even though he also is a good man, he'll have some issues in that way. As for the actual timing of the events, again, they're meant to take place, apparently, estimated, around 1050 to 970 BC. So about 80 years of time is covered here. And as I'm sure you remember, the main military antagonist of the Israelites and Samuel is the Philistines. They were a constant pester to the Israelites throughout this time. And they had established five city-states throughout the coastal region of Canaan. So they had a big presence there, and they were constantly starting fights with the Israelites and conflicts. And Saul and Jonathan will both lose their lives to them. And, of course, David will continue to have conflicts with them. So that's just a little historical setup. Anything on anything we've talked about before we get into the text? All right. So this morning, I'd like to go through 1 Samuel chapter 1. To chapter 2 and verse 11. We'll go ahead and read this part of the book. There was a certain man of Ramathaim Zophim of the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, son of Elihu, son of Tohu, son of Zuph, an Ephrathite. He had two wives. The name of the one was Hannah, and the name of the other, Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. Now this man used to go up year by year from his city to worship and to sacrifice to the Lord of hosts at Shiloh, where the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were priests of the Lord. On the day when Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Peninnah his wife and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah he gave a double portion, because he loved her, though the Lord had closed her womb. And her rival used to provoke her grievously to irritate her, because the Lord had closed her womb. So it went on year by year. As often as she went up to the house of the Lord, she used to provoke her. Therefore Hannah wept and would not eat. And Elkanah, her husband, said to her, "Hannah, why do you weep? And why do you not eat? Why is your heart sad? Am I not more to you than 10 sons? After they had eaten and drunk in Shiloh, Hannah rose. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat beside the doorstep of the temple of the Lord. She was deeply distressed and prayed to the Lord and wept bitterly. And she vowed a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your servant and remember me and not forget your servant, but will give to your servant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall touch his head. As she continued praying before the Lord, Eli observed her mouth. Hannah was speaking in her heart, only her lips moved, and her voice was not heard. Therefore Eli took her to be a drunken woman. And Eli said to her, How long will you go on being drunk? Put your wine away from you. But Hannah answered, No, my lord, I am a woman troubled in spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I have been pouring out my soul before the Lord. Do not regard your servant as a worthless woman, for all along I have been speaking out of my great anxiety and vexation. Then Eli answered, Go in peace, and the God of Israel grant your petition that you have made to him. And she said, Let your servant find favor in your eyes. Then the woman went her way and ate, and her face was no longer sad. They rose early in the morning and worshiped before the Lord. Then they went back to their house at Ramah. And Elkanah knew Hannah his wife, and the Lord remembered her. And in due time Hannah conceived and bore a son, and she called his name Samuel. For she said, I have asked for him from the Lord. The man Elkanah and all his house went up to offer to the Lord the yearly sacrifice and to pay his vow. But Hannah did not go up, for she said to her husband, As soon as the child is weaned, I will bring him, so that he may appear in the presence of the Lord and dwell there forever. Elkanah, her husband, said to her, Do what seems best to you. Wait until you have weaned him. Only may the Lord establish his word. So the woman remained and nursed her son until she weaned him. And when she had weaned him, she took him up with her, along with a 3-year-old bull, an ephah of flour, and a skin of wine. And she brought him to the house of the Lord at Shiloh, and the child was young. Then they slaughtered the bull, and they brought the child to Eli. And she said, O my Lord, as you live, my Lord, I am the woman who was standing here in your presence praying to the Lord. For this child I prayed, and the Lord has granted me my petition that I made to him. Therefore I have lent him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he is lent to the Lord. And he worshiped the Lord there. And Hannah prayed and said, My heart exults in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. My mouth derides my enemies, because I rejoice in your salvation. There is none holy like the Lord, for there is none beside you. There is no rock like our God. Talk no more so very proudly. Let not arrogance come from your mouth. For the Lord is a God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed. The bows of the mighty are broken, but the feeble bind on strength. Those who were full have hired themselves out for bread, but those who were hungry have ceased to hunger. The barren has borne 7, but she who has many children is forlorn. The Lord kills and brings to life. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. The Lord makes poor and makes rich. He brings low and exalts. He raises up the poor from the dust. He lifts the needy from the ash heap to make them sit with princes and inherit a seat of honor. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and on them he has set the world. He will guard the feet of his faithful ones, but the wicked shall be cut off in darkness. For not by might shall a man prevail. The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken to pieces. Against them he will thunder in heaven. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed. Then Elkanah went home to Ramah, and the boy was ministering to the Lord in the presence of Eli the priest. So a very dramatic beginning to this book. A woman who is barren earnestly pleads with God to have a child, and her petition is granted to her. It's interesting that 1 Samuel starts out with a similar phrase that is throughout Judges, actually. There was a certain man. That's how the story of Samson begins and a few other judges. So we still have those connections to the judges here. Is there any initial thoughts or comments based on the reading, John?
Yeah, I just remember specifically
Mm-hmm.
The last two stories in Genesis will start out with a certain
thing. Right, exactly. You know, I think we are meant to have judges in the back of our minds as we read through this transitionary period.
This story is going to go very differently from those two. Mm-hmm. I mean, those last few stories of judges did not go well.
Right.
And right before that was a special child that was born with a vowel attached to his life, and that really didn't go terribly well either.
Right.
So this is, I mean, there's a pretty significant contrast.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, and this provides a huge contrast. You know, we're immediately presented with these parents who go to worship the Lord at Shiloh yearly. They make it a priority to do this year after year. And of course, Peninnah doesn't seem like the most holy person or the most kind person, but Hannah and Elkanah still make this earnest effort to get to Shiloh to praise God. And so we're already presented with people who are actually godly people, who are trying to live righteously, trying to worship God in the correct way, which isn't something you find a lot of in the Judges.
Awesome. This is a little reminiscent of Abraham and Sarah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, what does it say about Hannah's barrenness? That's what I found really interesting that I never really picked up on in past readings of 1 Samuel, but it was actually given to her by the Lord. Greg? Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly. I read one commentary that described when Hannah actually finally has her child, it clears her character. You know, because back then people would say, oh, you're being punished for something you've done. But now that when she has that child, kind of clears her name. But yeah, it does remind you of Job, because in Job, God says, you know, I've done this to Job. Sure, it was Satan who actually pulled the trigger, I guess, but it was me who allowed it to happen. It was me who did this. And it kind of makes you think about, you know, I think, at least me, we're kind of scared to say when something bad is going on in our lives, to say, oh, God's doing this to me. But I think if we look at these stories where he openly says, I'm the one who did this, it can actually give us hope. And some sort of restoration for us. Did you have a comment, Joy?
Well, what you just said, it's like, even if God didn't actively do something, he's allowing it to happen.
Right.
So, and it's always up to him.
Right.
I just noticed that parts of Hannah's song is repeated in Psalm 113.
Mm-hmm. And that comes up when there are people who question the authenticity of Hannah's song, whether it was originally recorded or not. And my initial thought was, why can't she sing something like that? You know, we immediately think, oh, there's no way she actually had this perfect poetry coming out of her mouth as she was praising God, and maybe not. You know, we don't think that Job and his friends were speaking in perfect poetry, but we accept that as the record given to us. But, Ryan?
In regard to the idea of God kind of causing affliction, this way, mm-hmm. I think of John 9 with the blind man, where the disciple asks him, who's sinned, this man or his parents, when Jesus' reply is, neither really sinned for this to happen, but it's also for the glory of God.
Right. Exactly. Joy?
I actually thought the opposite regarding Hannah's prayer being quoted.
Right.
Because Psalms would come after.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things.
I don't know when
Right.
If she's the one that prayed it and it's quoting her, then Saul's...
Well, the assumption by critics or scholars would be that she's quoting someone else or that someone is quoting for her and putting it in here. And one of the biggest things is that she mentions a king at the end of it. And so people are like, well, there's no king in Israel, so she couldn't have said that. And so it must have been added by someone. But part of the problem is that people don't recognize this as probably a prophecy of some sort. Is that what you're going to say?
Yeah,
kind of different direction. Oh, go ahead. No, that was about finished. Right.
Well, and then once you start thinking of those lines, there are other connections to think about. You know, something of a miraculous birth, a child, temple, corrupt priesthood.
Right.
So there's connections looking forward and backward.
Right.
And like you said, it does kind of clear her name in multiple ways.
Right.
And that principle of God, and she even talks about that in her song, of God lifting up the lowly, bringing down the exalted, and then carry out in the fall of the house of Eli and throughout the rest of Samuel as a whole.
Right. You mentioned that Eli misunderstands her, and you know that part of that could be speaking to the state of Israel's worshipers at the time. That his first assumption when he sees a woman kneeling at the temple and her mouth, he just assumes, "Oh, she's drunk. I got another drunk in here again. What am I going to do with this one?" But yeah, Eli misunderstands her, and then her husband says, "Aren't I enough? You really want children? Why can't you just love me?" I don't know if there's anything supposed to be more significant in that these two men who interact with her completely misunderstand and have no idea what they're talking about, or if that's just an unfortunate coincidence, Nathan.
Because one of the last things that's said at the end of Ruth is you've got this daughter-in-law that's worth more than seven sons to Naomi. And now Elkanah is basically repeating that. I mean, it's a different number. It's, aren't I enough? Aren't I enough to you than, you know, 10 sons? And it really does sound like a pretty callous
right.
To say to a woman in grief about this kind of
thing. Exactly.
I'm not exactly sure how she would take it.
Right.
Kind of, you know, playing on that idea.
Mm-hmm. Right. Tom?
At least for all the married women, that lends authenticity to the story.
Oh, yeah. It's Hannah, it's really relatable right now. Although I've never thought Courtney was drunk when she wasn't, so. And then there's that mention of the temple of the Lord at Shiloh. And there's actually really no idea what building it's talking about. Historical excavations haven't found anything. There's really no mention other than stuff like this in the text about a temple. So it could have just been a shrine set up, just some sort of center of worship at Shiloh.
It was a tabernacle, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
The tabernacle,
probably.
The tent of meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, temple does indicate some type of more permanent structure.
Right.
Exactly. Solomon built,
mm-hmm.
obviously.
Right.
It, would be easy to envision that, of course, the tabernacle had been there, and they may have done things to make it more secure or permanent, since they're not going to stay there. They're not going to be around anymore.
Right.
That seemed to be the most likely thing here. But it surely would have been the tabernacle.
Right.
But it was made more fixed in
right.
some way.
I mean, yeah, it would have to be more permanent because it says year after year they did this, they had this journey.
And it could be that they're changing the verbiage for us because in Samuel 3:3 it says the temple of the Lord where the Ark of the Covenant is kept. So it may be a more fixed structure, but with not knowing when the time frame was, it could be, you know, rather than saying tabernacle,
mm-hmm. That's a possibility. We mentioned this vow that Hannah makes and how it's similar to the vow that Samson is meant to adhere to. But it's interesting, another contrast here between the two stories is that in Samson's story, the angel of the Lord says, hey, he's going to have this way of life that he needs to adhere to. And Hannah willingly volunteers this for him as part of her plea to God. Thought that was an interesting contrast. Greg?
I just thought Elkanah's response was sort of odd. What Hannah says, I'm going to bring him up to the temple and he's going to live forever there. And it's like, and he says, well, do what seems best to you.
Right. I think he was just really done having children. No. I mean, when you pair that with, aren't I enough? Can we just stop talking about it? No. It could be that he was just being incredibly supportive. Maybe he had grown to understand her situation a little better, how much she did want children, and how happy it made her that she had the children at all, that she would want to please God. And to keep her vow. And that's the thing, she made the vow, so he's not going to, you know, if he does care about pleasing God, he's not going to say, well, actually, you should probably keep the kid. You know, he'll want her to go through with what she's promised to God. Tom?
Yeah, well, that was one of the provisions in the law. The husband could veto his wife's vow.
Oh, really?
So, you know, he would have to be willing to go on with it. And that seems to be the point.
Right, yeah.
You know, I'm not going to hold you back for this. You
right.
did this.
Mm-hmm. Right. But that does bring us to where Elkanah says, only may the Lord establish his word. And I had a hard time understanding what he meant by that until I was looking at some commentaries. And actually, other manuscripts say, let you establish your word, let you keep your word, which to me makes more sense. But I didn't know if anyone had a comment on this version of the text where Elkanah says, may the Lord establish his word. I wasn't sure. I don't know what word he'd be referring to, because...
Yeah, my translation says, may the Lord help you keep your promise.
Yeah, I think that's probably more accurate. And we mentioned that Hannah's sacrificial spirit provides a stark contrast to the corruption found in Israel's spiritual leadership. It's another case of a woman putting forward a better example of how to follow God. And that's something that we see in Judges, putting a better example of how to follow God than some of these male spiritual leaders are doing. That God's kept his...
Yeah, that God's kept up his end of the bargain. Like
my first thought would be is that God never had to say yes, to her petition. He never made a promise saying, okay, I will do that for you. That's why I never understood which word Elkanah was talking about of the Lord's. This may be an arbitrary question because I have a specific answer in mind, but and I haven't asked one of those yet, so why not in the last 3 minutes? But what do you think the significance of Hannah's song is to the greater context of the book? Yeah.
Well, there's a foreshadowing at the end about he will give strength to his king. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Jonathan?
More generally, the theme of the prayer deals with God exalting the humble.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I believe both of those are correct. But I still have something else in mind. My thought was, it's just kind of funny that, you know, Hannah has this prayer of how great God is, how just God is, how powerful God is, how wonderful God is. In a few chapters, you're going to have the Israelites saying, hey, we need a king. We don't have anything like a king around here. What's going on? We need better leadership than this. And that's kind of how I saw it in the greater context of the story here, that right off the bat, you have someone, you know, lauding God on this, you know, insurpassable level, that he's great, he's just, he humbles the exalted and will exalt the humble. And yet, that's still not good enough for the Israelites. They still want something more, something better. Something more like the nations around them. Yeah?
I'm just so struck by this poetry. I mean, you have to find that here and switch it to poetry, and it ends with this messianic promise. It's the theme of God is going to bring the wicked down and lift up the righteous.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the lifting up of Hannah is, again, just a small picture of God kind of stepping into history and saying, well, here I am to bring judgment, and Hannah's rival, Peninnah, is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And Hannah was right to trust in me. And suddenly everything looks different.
Right.
And one day that's going to happen when Jesus comes.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the reasons why I love the phrase, and God remembered, because it's not, you know, one of those things where God forgot for a while, and then he's like, oh, shoot, I gotta give Hannah a baby. This is the introduction of God doing something to change the course of this person's life, and yeah, as you said, one day God will remember his people here. So, all right, well, thank you for your participation this morning. And we'll continue on next week.